Hey everybody, I'm Rita McGrath. You probably knew that. Welcome to a Friday Fireside Chat. Where I am in New York, it is a very gray, misty sort of day. Are you in New York as well, Kai?
Same, misty in Harlem.
Misty and kind of good weather to go to bed by. But anyway, welcome to a Friday Fireside Chat. Just as a reminder, this is being recorded, so don't say anything you do not want your distant relatives to learn about you through this vehicle. As I said, I'm Rita McGrath, and my guest this week is Kai D. Wright, who is a young phenom in the world of brand building and sort of advertising, teaches at Columbia, has a column in Ad Age, and does a whole bunch of other things. And so we're going to talk about his new book, or newish book, I guess, which I have right here, called Follow the Feeling. And if any of you have wanted to understand why things go viral, what makes one thing more attractive than another, there are many, many different ways of doing that.
You know, it's really a space of influence that's been growing quite significantly. A lot of individuals may follow Jonah Berger and the work that he does in terms of word of mouth and what makes something go viral. And so if you like that type of work in terms of contagious and persuasion, then you probably would like this idea of how to build brands through communities.
Yeah, well, maybe, first of all, let's just tell our guests your story. I think it's always interesting to know kind of the journey that people have been on as they're getting to where they are. And then I would love to dig into the viral book, and just by way of how we met through your Ad Age column, which is really about breaking through existing barriers and creating real change in the world. And I was very fortunate to be sort of on a little mini panel with a very notable figure from the advertising world. So you made that possibility happen, and I was very grateful for that. So tell us a little bit about where you came from and what you're up to.
Absolutely. So as you referenced, I've worked in advertising, media, and communication for 15 years. And I've worked mostly at agencies, including Ogilvy for 5 years, Global Powerhouse, and more recently, Dentsu. As I work at different agencies, I also teach. And so I'm a scholar practitioner. And I've taught at Columbia for going on 12 years now. And I teach a course at the intersection of brand building, behavioral science, and communication. I absolutely love it. And what got me interested in the intersection of those things was Gary Becker. And I know on Monday, there's going to be an announcement for the next Nobel Prize in Economics. And so I studied economics at the University of Chicago. I took classes with him twice. And he is a powerhouse when it comes to demographics and migration. And I love culture. And you can't really have a conversation without culture or create a strategy that's built on culture without passing through the lens of demographics and how people move and migrate. And so that course, a series of courses at Booth, got me interested in advertising. And I started right out of college.
Interesting. Because I've always put Becker down as like the human capital guy, right?
Yeah. Well, he has a number of different things that he has over his pretty illustrious 50-year career of teaching have come up with.
That's great. That's great. So that's how you got into advertising. So you're in Chicago, and you started this Ad Age column. And what motivated you to do that?
There were a couple of motivators, Rita. The first one was I was working in the industry, and in 2020, Ad Age decided to start a diversity council, and we all remember 2020, and there's over 1,000 organizations that pledge commitments in terms of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Mm-hmm. I was very lucky to be able to use my scholar practitioner perspective to join the Diversity Council, which had 20 different, mostly C-suite and presidents on it. And I was really representing the perspective of a millennial that understood digital and at the same time had worked in a couple of cultural environments before. So it worked for Diddy for instance, in the music industry to help him start
Rebel. That must be cool. It's good to hang out with cool people when you work with people like that.
Yeah, so I was the head of communication and PR for Revolt TV when it launched over 10 years ago, and really understood if you're trying to tell different stories, create new narratives, make platforms more accessible, what are some of the challenges in terms of doing that? So when I joined the Diversity Council, we would have conversations every single month. And it's been 3.5 years now that we've been having conversations. And through those conversations, we're able to share where individuals are having wins and where there are obstacles. So the show System Overload was built out of actively listening for about 2 years and then saying, what more can we do to help bridge a gap that individuals have? And that gap really is strategic frameworks that help them move forward through failure. And as you put it, see around corners so they can really understand the big opportunity if they just keep pushing towards progress incrementally. And so the show was an opportunity for us to take a systems-based view on the industry and bring in some outside experts that have been entrusted in other industries and all around the world, advising organizations to give that perspective of how other industries have achieved change and what those experts have learned over their careers. And so you mentioned one of the shows, which also had Kristen Cavallo on it, who is the CEO of the Martin Agency. And more recently, I think maybe 3 weeks after that show, then got a promotion to be global CEO of MullenLowe, which is another agency. So she wears many hats. Mm-hmm. And I love having guests on like that, that represent both educators that can help figure out how to scale change, mm-hmm. and then doers and decision makers that have the influence to make sure that everyone's moving in the same direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, so one of the kind of really interesting things that I thought she was doing actively promoting was creating diversity in the supply community, you know, the small vendors that she was using. And what I thought was particularly fascinating was for a lot of companies, you know, they'll say, yeah, you know, we're looking for women-owned businesses or, you know, underrepresented group-owned businesses or whatever. And it's just on a form someplace. It's like a tick-the-box exercise. But what she was doing, which I thought was really interesting, was she was going to these companies and she was saying to them, look, what you're giving me right now isn't going to work for what we need, but here's your path to being able to offer us something we could use. And so helping them upgrade and upskill their offerings, which I thought was, you know, just that's really taking that extra step forward and saying, well, what are the barriers between these new firms being able to do this? I was teaching all week in a course up at Columbia for one of our custom program mm-hmm. clients. And one of our guests was a gentleman by the name of Robert Livingston, who's written this fantastic book, The Conversation. Do you know Robert?
Yes, I know of his work. Yeah.
He's wonderful. But, you know, he again uses the example of structural change. When the Massachusetts Industrial Authority, they look after the ports and the, you know, the infrastructure. And they said, what we're going to do is the normal criteria would be, you know, design and cost and the architectural skill. And they said, we're going to add, in addition to those three, we're going to also weight diversity. And what was interesting to me was they didn't define what diversity was. So these guys had to go out and now find, you know, female architects and, you know, Black owned carpentry companies. And it was interesting, the reaction of the folks initially, the incumbents who'd always gotten these awards, these contracts awarded. And initially they were like, oh, this is so much more work. And then once they put in the work, they said, but this is great. You know, we've got huge amounts of talent that we'd never tapped into before. We've got, you know, diversity of thought we'd never had before, really creative solutions we didn't know about. And so it turned out that even though the initial sort of effort is like, oh, so much more work, at the end of the day, you know, building those bridges becomes something that adds a lot of value.
Huge value. And I'm a firm believer in the atomic habit principle of just 1% incremental change, right? We don't have to completely overhaul the system overnight because that probably wouldn't work. From an experimentation standpoint, it's what most researchers wouldn't recommend either. You want to do small changes, experiment, see if you've isolated the variable that has a change. And so a lot of the work that you're describing around Robert Livingston, figuring out what is the process that should be used, what are the definitions that we should continue to nuance, are things that I love to go back to, you know, based on the research of a Dartmouth professor and MacArthur fellow, Donella Meadows, who was educated at MIT. And so she had that kind of process-driven thinking, but then applied it to sustainability and environmentalism. And so a lot of the principles around systems-based thinking and the reason why I named the show System Overload is rooted in her work. But the same general idea that you're describing, how can we go about getting change by testing our way and learning our way through? And often that means becoming comfortable with failure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's some corners of the academic world where I'm literally known as Mrs. Failure. Because if you work in innovation or science or any field which has a lot of uncertainty to it, you know, failure happens all the time. And what I encourage people to focus on is, I said, you know, worry a lot less about the rate of failing, because, you know, in a system where you're depending on high reliability and everybody's got to know what they're doing and all that, you know, you don't want to fail a lot. Like, I don't want the pilot of my next plane doing a radical experiment with engine technology. No. Really, no, you know, but at the same time, if you're trying something new with a way a screw is attached to something and you try it and it doesn't work, you know, you go back. And one distinction I really like is the one they use at Amazon about the difference between what they call type one and type two thinking. And type one decisions are consequential, they're important, they matter. If you get it wrong, it's going to be a big problem. And those require a lot of careful thought. Type two decisions are, you know, reversible. If you don't like, you walk through the door. If you don't like what's on the other side, you walk back through. And we tend to treat everything in companies, especially big successful ones, as though they're all type one decisions, when most of the time they're not, right?
Mm-hmm. And we've gone through a grand experiment within the last 3 years of remote work, hybrid work, really new ways of working. And many organizations are still going through, to your point, those experiments. You know, can't walk back and reverse like this trend of giving more individuals freedom and autonomy over maybe when they work, but not necessarily the volume of their output. And we've seen a lot of positive benefits in terms of productivity and fulfillment and happiness, which may not have been there if individuals weren't empowered to make those type one, type two decisions.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with you. And I think the whole kind of debate about return to office, you know, I think it almost misses the point, because what we want is organizations that empower human flourishing, right? And sometimes that means creative problem solving together as a group. And sometimes that means quiet work where you're just really thinking on your own and then you have something to offer the group when you're finished that process. And sometimes it's some mishmash. What I think though, and I go all the way back to the work of Thomas Allen, who was an MIT professor, probably working in the 70s. And he came up with something called the Allen curve, which I don't know if you're aware of, but basically he was interested in how scientific knowledge was shared among scientists. Mm-hmm. So the bottom dimension of his graph was sort of how many feet apart were these people sitting? So how regularly were they like in close proximity to each other? And then the vertical dimension, he had a thing he called information richness. Mm-hmm. And what he found was information rich, and then it falls off a cliff. And it was called the Allen curve because they replicated it in situation after situation. And they found that once individuals were physically not in regular contact, in other words, they were sitting more than 60 feet apart, the information richness just fell off. And what that means is if you're not co-located with somebody and you're seeing them on a regular basis, you actually have to put in a lot more effort to make sure the information flows are there, to make sure that the substance is there. And what I see in many workplaces with people that I've talked to is prospect of putting in that effort is not something that's very appealing to a great many managers. You know, they just would rather everybody was in the office and they wouldn't have to worry about it, which isn't true either, because, you know, we're all traveling and moving around. So I think it's just an interesting variable. So tell us about the book. So Follow the Feeling. Whoops, wrong tech. Wrong way. Follow the Feeling. Brand Building in a Noisy World. And I think I can't imagine there's anybody that's with us today that wouldn't be interested in, how do I get a brand to go viral? What are the, you know, community, what's the recipe? So tell us a little bit about that.
Exactly. Well, Rita, that book I started working on in 2015. Oh, wow. And had this, and then it came out in 2019. And I'm one of those researchers that really loves to spend time with the subject, nuance it, get it right. But more importantly, as an educator, develop a process, a very simple framework. And so the research involved looking at 1,500 fast-growing companies, wow, companies like Peloton, Stitch Fix, SoulCycle, Barry's Bootcamp. And those are just, you know, some within the fitness category. So looking across other categories also and figuring out between this period of 2015 and 2018, why were they taking off? And we had a lot of major things like digital transformations that were happening, more imagined communities that were developing, more affinities, more multiculturalism in terms of between the generations. And so people were finding a lot of things to talk about. And a lot of brands were becoming like cult brands, not just culturally attuned, but actually cult brands. Mm-hmm. And so that fascination is really what led to the book, to figure out, are there some secrets or shortcuts, mm-hmm, in this world where there's more content than ever, right? Kind of what's uploaded to YouTube and TikTok is absolutely exploding to the point that people are more likely to go, if, at least if you're Gen Z, on TikTok and search for an answer, mm-hmm, then go on Google and search for an answer. And so when we have those kind of big major shifts, wanted to help brands understand, how do you navigate that? Where should you invest time? Where should you invest money? Mm-hmm. And when the book came out, I was then able to spend a couple of years consulting with different companies and really figuring out, does it work? Does it work for startups? Does it work for Fortune 100 companies? Does the scale of the budget or the reach of media spend have any implications? And it's been a simple enough system. It's just 5 parts: lexicon, audio, visuals, experience, and culture that individuals can activate. And so the book goes through 60 of the outlier examples of organizations that were growing the fastest. And many individuals have said over time, they're like, well, will they sustain the growth? And Peloton was one of the companies that a lot of organizations and individuals were looking at, and they're still around. All 60 of the organizations profiled in the book as fast growing, even though the pandemic has happened and there's been changes in terms of how individuals spend money with inflation as a backdrop, and changes within work. The businesses have still continued to exist and succeed.
It's pretty interesting. And so can you elaborate a little bit more on each of the 5?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So most organizations will start with lexicon and words. And we know that words are limited in terms of their meaning making. Mm-hmm. There's only like 1,000 new words that get added to the dictionary every year. Whereas if you think about audio and visuals, there's millions that get added almost down to the day, because it's easier for individuals to create within those spaces. Mm-hmm. So when we think about branding and brand building, the level of noise is much louder when it comes to certain types of mediums and touch points as opposed to others. And so there tends not to be the most noise within lexicon. There's a very limited range of what you can say, but that range can often stifle creativity. And so even working at different agencies, I experienced this, where I often see project ideation that may end up being an experience or a commercial or something else start with a written brief. Mm-hmm. And when you have to reduce down so much creativity to a finite amount of language, then it doesn't always lead to the most inspiring or the most emotive work. And so in the research that I do around behavioral science, my goal is to activate emotions. So those emotions motivate and move people. And we find that we can activate more emotions when we use audio. We can activate more emotions when we use visuals, symbols, and emojis, GIFs, memes, all those things that have derived out of modern pop culture. And so we see brands that look at trends and they kind of hijack the trends because they may be quick on social media on their feet to come up with a visual that supports it. Or they may be great at integrating a music song that's taking off on TikTok into a commercial so that they're learning from one channel to another on how to capture attention, because we know that attention is declining. And so the faster we can get someone to feel something, the more likely we are to activate them to make a decision that may be favorable. So that's usually lexicon, audio, and visuals. And audio, Rita, is the area that brands have the most opportunity in. Often having visuals, and that put this in the book, the Burt Box test. If you were to close your eyes and think of a brand, your favorite brand, 80% of the time, according to Martin Lindstrom, there would not be any attributable audio to that company. And so it is a huge opportunity because a lot of brands borrow equity from big music. And I've been there. I remember once we were doing some commercials for a spirits company, paid $500,000 to license a soundtrack for, or license one album from a rock band that was very popular just for 6 months, $500,000, right? For 6 months of borrowed equity. And it used to be that organizations would create jingles and that would carry through an audio. But today, less than 10% of companies have a jingle, less than 10% of companies have a mnemonic device at all. And so the organizations that really find what their lane is that they can be the most emotive in can grow brand value quite fast. And so organizations like AT&T, for instance, which both develop audio cues and redid their logo in 2015, have already said that audio is in that logo sonic identity is the most valuable brand asset, more valuable than the actual mark on the brand. And if you're thinking of content like Netflix, that ta-dum that plays or that white noise that's in the HBO intro, those are all sonic devices that have worked really well. And, you know, Netflix actually turned that ta-dum into an event and into an experience. And now they're starting to expand beyond it. And they, on an annual basis, will have different stars and celebrities come together and preview different content. And so, you know, the goal really is to figure out how can you activate something within a central community that you're trying to connect with that's culturally going to be relevant for them. Mm-hmm. My favorite part of the five-part system is experience, mm-hmm. which is all around rituals. And so if you think about organizations like Oreo is all about, right, lick, twist, dunk. That is the place from a mental construct that you want to be if you have a brand. It doesn't matter whether your brand is a startup or a 100-year-old company like Oreo, you still can develop a habit that individuals do either by themselves or as part of a community. And that's really what gets a brand to break through the noise, when there is this sense of, how do I use it? What do I do with it? And it's fun and it's emotive, but it really unlocks this deep feeling that's positive for individuals to have. The last part, culture. The simple rule that I give in terms of navigating culture is make sure that you're empowering a community. That's it.
Empowering
about empowering a community.
Oh, and I see.
Yeah, we often talk about triple bottom line, right? Be good for people and profit, and in trying to balance being good for planet also. So those three things. It's about asking the community, what issues are you facing? Which ones do you want us as a brand to lean forward in? And then you show the earnestness and the empathy towards those things that they communicate. Often brands make commitments, and it's kind of like, Why are you committing to that thing? So, for instance, it might be a food brand, and rather than solving an issue that may be core to their business, such as making sure that, families or children have nutritious meals to eat, they may go out and say, "We're going to tackle planting trees." It's not to say planting trees isn't great, but for your community, doing something that's going to empower them, is the best choice to make if you have a field of choices. So those five different lanes of lexicon, audio, visuals, and experience and culture, different organizations can wrap their brand around them, and it becomes a better way to position a brand than simply saying, "We're going to come out with a tagline," or "We're going to come out with a slogan that may not be as evocative."
So one of our guests, Frank Kalberg, would like to know, to what extent will advertising become more interactive and in what ways?
Ooh, Frank, that is a really great question. I think we see these experiences like Pokemon Go, right? And it blurs the lines. And I think that's where really great interactive and advertising and promotion around a brand lives, when it doesn't feel like advertising. It just feels like you're having this fun experience with the brand. So many individuals were using AR in order to run around of all different ages and capture the Pokemon in their backyard or at parks or different locations. People were saying, "Oh, this Pokemon is over there." And then people would cluster and go. So the brand created an interaction that got individuals talking to each other. And that's the cheat code and the unlock for the next level of how to break through the noise. You don't break through the noise by advertising and overspending. You break through by empowering people to then want to connect with each other, so that community becomes a little self-reliant. And then the purpose of the brand is really to get the community, different, assets and opportunities in order to be able to kind of like geek out around the best of what they think is part of the brand. But I would say advertising that really relies on community members, connecting with community members, that's probably the best place. I mentioned earlier that I did some work with Revolt TV, and it's within the space of music and culture. And what we often find is that some of the strongest communities that don't have to advertise are music artists. Because music artists, and if you go to a concert, doesn't matter whose concert you go to, it can be in any genre, you often will see that fans are singing together. They're having this instant bonding experience that brings them together. And a music artist is never able to have a one-on-one conversation with the millions of fans that they have. So it's really an ecosystem that works when people are able to connect with other people and have some sense of shared experience. And so the brands that are going to grow the fastest in the future, and the brands that are going to be the most efficient with media spend, are going to figure out how to not rent advertising real estate, like a banner site or a print ad in a paper or magazine, something that's going to be replaced within the next day or the next month or the next hour, but to foster relationships between individuals so those individuals become champions.
That's so interesting. I'm thinking now of the Barbie movie,
Oh,
and
yeah.
I mean, there were entire like theaters full of people dressed up in like sparkly pink, and even the guys got into it. They were like, "And Ken," but I
Some
mean, very
people.
similar to what you're talking about, right? It became a thing to do, right? And people
Absolutely.
would see the
Absolutely.
movie multiple times just
Yeah.
because, it was just they were so interesting. The other thing that fascinates me about Barbie is, that's a pretty old brand. It has been around for many, many decades, and yet they've tapped into something super interesting. And I have to give Greta Gerwig enormous credit for this, to take that kind of very traditional, right down to the, who wears stiletto heels like that on a regular basis anymore, right? But to take that and kind of wittily update it to current sensibilities, I thought was really, really interesting.
Yes, and I know Barbie really well. Actually, Barbie has one of the highest familiarities in terms of toys. 9 out of 10 children all around the world have played with a Barbie before they became a teenager. And at Columbia, for the last 6 years, I've taught a case study on Barbie. So even going back to, you know, the 1950s with Ruth Handler and her origin story, you know, she wanted it to be about imagination. And imagination is one of those things that is very evocative. And so they had a core emotion built in. They have experienced, you know, a number of different things like beauty issues, body issues, but they've developed more recently because individuals have been able to project themselves into Barbie. They've changed different body sizes. They've diversified the types of careers that Barbie has had. I think Barbie now has over 100 different types of careers and that she can represent. And they've also made Barbie have different abilities. Mm-hmm. And so there are Barbies that may be in a wheelchair. The Barbie Dreamhouse now has a ramp if you want to have imaginative play with a Barbie that may have a disability. And so they've really tried, and they've added a number of communication around boys. Mm-hmm. And so as a traditional toy that generally were for girls, they've really expanded mm-hmm. as culture has mm-hmm. expanded and listened. You know, Rita, one of the reasons why the Barbie movie took off so well, there were over 160 brand partners that included Barbie in their marketing and communication. And their companies, luxury companies from Balmain that were making luggage to organizations like Progressive that were insuring the Barbie Dreamhouse to Airbnb that were letting people stay in the Malibu Barbie Dreamhouse. And so you've talked about a part of the fandom culture, mm-hmm. which is individuals dressing up. And I think that's going to be a trend in the future, really allowing fans to immerse themselves fully within the, you know, IP. Mm-hmm. Disney and companies like that have created their theme parks. They've been really great on the experiential ritual side, but other organizations are really finding traction when it comes to creating long form content and building on those storylines that people love and that create a sense of community. And to your point, a lot of people have seen it more than once. Now, I have a feeling that's going to be streaming a lot over the holidays as families and friends and groups are getting together for their different celebrations. But Greta, absolutely one of the best directors, and it's already the top grossing movie in Warner Brothers' 100-year history. So she has set the bar very high.
Very high. So we had another question from Edward Ford, who raises a really interesting issue, which is, you know, we've been talking so far mostly about corporate brands, you know, or company brands, brands where there's an organization trying to sell things to people. But now we're in this really interesting situation where individuals are building their brands. And I can see you as really being central to this phenomenon, you know, independent perhaps of the corporate brands. So like in my world, there's a lot of talk about thought leadership and what makes a thought leader. Does it matter more that you're at a place like Columbia where I happen to be, or does it matter more that you're a frequent, you know, publisher in Fortune or the Harvard Business Review or Vogue or something? How do companies navigate that? Because it's got to be, I mean, it's moving normal organizations closer to where like Hollywood studios have always been, or you know, radio stations or something, where you've got these talents that have their own brands.
Absolutely. I mean, with the invention of so many platforms like Twitter, where it's easy to have a short piece of content as opposed to having to compete to have a whole documentary or a long form or a television show, which has so many hurdles. If you have a point of view, you can just go live now and you can create a 1-minute version of it. You can create a, you know, 100 character version of your point of view. And so the democratization of who gets to speak and whose ideas and media gets to get amplified is more present today than ever. And so that is creating a huge opportunity for individuals to create their own brands. There's so much change, and we get so many questions around brand building. The original research is around organizations. And the next book that's being written is around people.
This is your next book. Oh, yeah. I think you told me about that.
And so that book is all about the cultural phenomena of where does creators come from? Where do influencers come from? And how do you monetize your point of view, if you have one, whether it's creating a course or creating a YouTube channel, writing a book, or creating a Shopify store where you're taking different things and making the e-commerce platform based on it. The number of people who have over a million followers on social media may shock you. Mm-hmm. It's over a million people. So it's no longer a small group of influencers. They're everywhere. If you were to go on TikTok and go on Instagram nowadays, most influencers have well between 100,000 and 500,000 followers. But that ecosystem we find actually works best when individuals have micro audiences. So that's, to me, you don't have to get to the point of hundreds of thousands of followers to be influential. Influence comes through authenticity, and that can be achieved with just 10,000 followers. Mm-hmm. So there is, I think, more of a urgency, especially with hyperinflation and individuals experiencing the great resignation, wanting to change jobs, wanting to have more flexibility, and the ease of reskilling themselves. You know, on-demand education. If you don't know how to put together a website, watch a YouTube video. Do it side by side. Like, it's very easy to become the thing that you've always been putting off being. Mm-hmm. And as those mega trends happen, they're all enabling and empowering a new class of individuals to monetize their voice and to monetize their talents and their skills. And that's really exciting. It has benefits for companies too. Mm-hmm. And so at South by Southwest in 2024, I'm going to unveil some of the next research from the book. The positive benefits of employers mm-hmm. even supporting their employees of having personal brands. So mm-hmm. to give you one example, when you think about hiring, about 70% of individuals get hired based on who they know rather than applying to a job. So hiring very much is a person-to-person mm-hmm. Type, at least within certain roles, like within corporate America. Mm-hmm. And with that, Cisco conducted an experiment. They wanted to see how influential their employees were with using their own personal brand in order to fill a challenge that an organization had. And Rita, I don't know if you can guess. They trained their 82,000 employees, this is Cisco, on how to use social media and how to help them fill roles. What do you think the average time is to identify a talent and start the interview process at Cisco based on activating their employees?
I don't know, a couple of days?
Couple of days. A process that could normally take weeks or months to identify top talent, they got it down to 5 days. By activating the personal brands.
Social media.
Correct. Yeah.
So the person, let's say, would go on platform of choice and say, hey, we've got a role at Cisco. Anybody interested, call me, or something like that. Would that be how that would work?
One way, but mm-hmm. they've also done some deeper training. We've seen these philosophies around the power of personal brands related to social selling is kind of the first incarnation of it. The Facebooks of the world and LinkedIns of the world have always said, activate your personal relationships by giving a little bit of information, a little bit of guidance. You do this really well in terms of going in social media and sharing reports and insights and other things. So part of it is not only saying and declaring that there may be an opportunity, but creating a hook, showcasing the culture of an organization, making it personal so that it's down to what team are they working on? Why should they work on that, right? Things that may not be inherent in a job description that really turns what could be a direct, non-emotive advertisement for a job into a very personal recommendation for a community through the lens of that employee. And that's what we're seeing, where we're seeing brands win. When the message can be carried from person to person and individuals feel the level of fulfillment and happiness and productivity at work to want to bring other people into that system. So there are some hurdles that organizations have in terms of motivating employees to want to open their networks. And that's creating, I think, more of an opportunity for organizations to say, we don't need to maximize against productivity all the time. We actually need to give employees some time to be curious and to do other things, because those things, like being in social media, is going to help us. There's some organizations that actually block individuals from going on social media during the day. So you can kind of get a sense of how policy might prevent an organization from growing. And I love all the experiments that are happening with the Ciscos of the world and other ones to really find what's that right balance, right? Most organizations want to protect their IP. Most organizations want to make sure that they control a narrative. Most organizations want to make sure that their employees are behaving and representing them well in terms of social media, and they're productive. So that often becomes reasons to say no. But I think now we're finding a lot of reasons to say yes. And when we look at TikTok and a lot of younger generations, especially Gen Z, Gen Alpha, that's coming into the workforce with 10,000 followers, 100,000 followers, they now have more influence than a CEO often. And so it is important from a marketing standpoint and from an employer branding standpoint to be able to empower those individuals to activate their 100,000 or million followers when a CEO may only have 1,000 or a CEO may only have 10,000. So we're really rethinking influence and where influence comes from and what it looks like. And seeing that there's another set of employees who may not have this big title, may not have the tenure of 20 years within the organization, but can very quickly fill a pipeline in terms of recruitment if we make the right type of TikTok video.
That's so interesting. And it, you know, I'm reminded of a time I was at an Interbrand sort of retreat. And one of the speakers was talking about social media fails on the part of big companies. And one of the most egregious was some company put up, I don't know the name of their product or their brand. And after it, they had a little copyright sign, like in their tweet, thinking this was clearly created by some corporate person. I mean, and it gets us back to this question of what is authentic, right? And a couple of our listeners have asked two things. One about what does it look like to have an authentic expression? And then the other interesting topic that's, of course, on everybody's mind is AI and what's going on with AI. And how's that going to fit into this whole mix of things?
Those are two big topics. All right. So to start with the first one, and you may have to bring me back to AI as well.
Okay.
Answer that question of what authenticity is. We've had a lot of conversations across different organizations for a number of different social movements and reasons, from Me Too to pay equity to social justice coming out of 2020, sustainability, there'll be more issues that come in the future. And when we think about most organizations, they weren't created to be purpose-driven. They weren't created to solve issues or causes. And so that creates this conflict with a lot of management and shareholders to say, are we really doing what we were designed to do? Is authenticity part of our DNA in terms of communicating about these issues? So there's some like corporate imposter syndrome is what I will call it around authenticity that is playing out right now. So often help organizations to figure out how do you get out of this corporate imposter syndrome and do something that actually is believable. And it starts from resetting the finish line. And that means rather than trying to simply create forums to listen to individuals, which is what a lot of organizations will do with employee engagement surveys, it's about action. And it's not any type of action that you take. It is action that empowers people. And so that's often what I say. If you can get to empowerment, people will believe that you're being authentic. Empowerment is where that is that sweet spot. But there are two other parts of empowerment. So you can think of it kind of like a triangle. Empowerment is one piece. Authenticity is in the middle. So you have empowerment, you have empathy. In order to empower individuals, you have to listen to them and they have to be part of the process. So just to give you an example, taking it back to marketing, there is a professor at the University of Michigan at Ross at Business School, Marcus Collins. He's the former chief strategy officer of Wieden & Kennedy, which is a highly regarded advertising agency that he and I, you mentioned Innerbrand. And he just wrote a book called For the Culture. And what he talks about is this kind of sometimes unauthentic or disingenuous cultural appropriation that happens when an organization says, ooh, I want to market to that group of people, but they don't have people who work there that are part of that community, but they want to use that culture for growth purposes, right? Or they may want to navigate into the territory of partnerships or doing other things, but they don't have processes internally of even like having diverse suppliers, or even having individuals that on the research side are getting insights from those different groups. So they're trying to use kind of these macro insights from general populations rather than getting really nuanced insights from different communities. And so that's where empathy comes in. It's about asking, how can you make the invisible visible? How can you make the voices that typically are not heard, heard? And that is when an organization starts to get closer to authenticity, when those processes for decision-making and research starts to align with the communities who they want to activate. And then lastly, it's earnestness. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you an example of authenticity from an earnest standpoint. Sometimes we have desire to make change, and we understand that within our industry, it may be lacking change. So I'll give the example of the real estate industry. Within the real estate industry, in earnestness, a lot of individuals want to solve homelessness or the pricing of rent and rent control, because that may be growing faster than the socioeconomics of what individuals are earning in an area. So if we isolate that, we say, okay, let's be authentic in this area of real estate and housing, solve homelessness, which is what people need. But what the real estate industry has done is they've said, we're going to rename master bedroom to primary bedroom.
I know.
Right? And so when you go on Zillow, when you go on a lot of websites, that's the big thing that has changed within the real estate industry within the last 5 years, is this renaming pat on the back that people have given them of saying, we don't need to call things master bedroom anymore. They'll be primary bedroom, and it's more inclusive language. People aren't asking for inclusive language. People are asking for housing. So it's like, we also, as decision makers, as leaders, as marketers, once we listen to people, it's about solving the things that they ask us to, and not doing the easy things that give the semblance that there's progress. And so authenticity, you can remember, are in the intersection of those three things: empowering people, being empathetic in terms of the way decisions are made, and then being earnest in terms of solving the issues that individuals are asking to be solved.
Well, and to go back to the, you know, representative members of your workforce, if you want to appeal to a certain community, I mean, there are all these misses that happened around, I think it was Juneteenth, where, you know,
yeah,
just like, you know, you look at them and you go, what were you thinking? Like, did you have right. nobody on your team that could say this was a really terrible idea?
You're absolutely right. In major companies, right? Like, I remember there were things being pulled off the shelves from Walmart because they had like ice cream.
I think it was
for Juneteenth, right? And so just one example of something, it's like, we don't want to eat our fillings on Juneteenth. We want to do something else. And that's one of the challenges, Rita. A lot of savvy marketers will look at the gaps within culture and say, where is culture going? And then what role can the brand play that's meaningful. And one of those areas, even related to something like Juneteenth, is it's been celebrated and recognized in certain states. Now it's on the federal level, national level, and getting attention.
Mm-hmm.
There are no rituals for Juneteenth, right? So if I put my branding hat on and apply the branding system of Levac and Gota experience with rituals, it's missing. People don't know what to do. That's a great opportunity for a brand. Mm-hmm. Maybe Netflix can come up with content or something for Juneteenth, or maybe another organization can really be mindful of what is that recurring thing people do every single year. And when we think about holidays, we know what we do for, you know, Christmas. People mostly give gifts. We know what people do for Thanksgiving. They mostly get together and eat food. We know what people do for 4th of July, maybe a barbecue and fireworks and other things. So when we think about even the branding of holidays or days or movements, people need rituals. They need experiences that that are going to bring them together. And I think companies are still trying to figure it out, but it's a huge opportunity for a brand to create some value for a lot of individuals, because, you know, it's great that it's amplified. Different organizations take different approaches in terms of what they do during that day or during that week or weekend. But there still has to be this elevation of what do you do? Mm-hmm. And then we'll be, I think, in this place of organizations not having to guess and can be authentic on those types of days that are really meaningful for different communities that they might be marketing to or interacting with.
I love that, that's an opportunity. You know what it makes me think of is our concept of like Santa Clauses that ended up in, you know, department store Santas and everything. That was mm-hmm. actually invented by the Coca-Cola company. I mean, they're the people that popularized that, right? If you go all the way back to like the initial popularization of the Santa Claus we all know is, you know, the bearded guy with the big belly. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, there was the Christmas, the poem, but Coca-Cola was really the one that visually brought it into the public imagination. So I think it's fascinating. We've got a similar opportunity with other holidays. So quick word on artificial intelligence before our time is going to be up.
All right. Well, first, the time flew by way too
fast. Really did.
Okay. So artificial intelligence. Wow. As it relates to branding, there's so many opportunities. You know, within the agency world, there is a level of productivity that I think will get unlocked. There are, you know, I think some individuals like an artificial intelligence to like a plane on autopilot. That it's this rogue thing that's going to fly itself and then it's going to get out of control and we're never going to be able to pull it back. But the way I view AI is it is very much dependent on user input, user feedback. Like it needs us, right? Mm-hmm. We can't just have the plane or the thing or a self-driving car, you know, go forever. At some point it has to plug in and recharge. At some point mm-hmm. it has to have some type of user input in order to recalibrate. So even as a system or a piece of technology, it needs people in order to continue to improve. I don't see AI ever being this self-sufficient thing that is going to eliminate the need of humans. And then it's a matter of how does it impact creativity? And we see whether it's PricewaterhouseCoopers, PwC, or a number of other consultancies, they're saying 40% of jobs are going to be impacted by it. It doesn't mean negatively impacted. There was a piece of research that came out of the Wall Street Journal in September that said the sweet spot for productivity, and a lot of AI and the argument for AI is around productivity, is 85%. After that, you get burnout. Mm-hmm. So we shouldn't aim to be 100% productive all the time, going back to your example of Alan and the information, how proximate we are. It's like, no, sometimes, you know, it's okay to do some other things, but about 85%. So we think of what will get us to that 85%. So individuals won't experience burnout. And there's a lot of industries that we've seen, and McKinsey has started to quantify this. I think they have an AI bot called Lily, and they're taking all their knowledge and putting it within that thing. It's about helping humans to make better decisions. And I think that is the ultimate end goal of it, and also illuminating different opportunities. I mean, we're still in the middle of the actor strike. We just resolved the writer strike, and AI is one of the core parts that's holding it up. And individuals, they want credit. They want to make sure that they're compensated, and AI isn't eliminating that aspect of their livelihood, which is inclusive of creativity, right? If they're not credited and compensated, then the creativity is going to be stifled. At the same time, organizations like Disney been around, you know, for long enough that they're about to lose their protections on Mickey Mouse in the next 3 years. They are desperate to figure out how do they innovate around IP that's existing. And so for a lot of organizations, I think they're using AI to figure out the productivity challenge and using it to figure out how do they innovate to get the most out of all the assets that they've created. And meanwhile, as humans, as workers, and there's so many strikes happening, trying to make sure that we have the ability to have a livelihood in the future. And I think what it's going to come down to is people are going to have to reskill, whether they want to or not. People
That's are going to historically.
Exactly.
I mean, the technological revolution has required people to do that, right?
Yes. Yes. And I think we're seeing individuals fight against the next version of a revolution that's happening, and that revolution is coming, right? We saw it with the Industrial Revolution, where people reskilled, but they reskilled to a highly specialized thing. And I think now we're seeing more like the book Range. People are reskilling to be generalists. Mm-hmm. It's less about being good at one thing and good about having curiosity, and then using that curiosity to go and find different resources within a DIY culture where you don't have to be a technical expert. You just have to have the curiosity to watch the YouTube video as you build the website, or watch a TikTok as you do something else. On-demand education has exploded. It's up 400% within the last 2 years. So there is a generation that is foregoing college. Like between 2010 and 2020, college enrollment in the US has declined 25%. That's one of the reasons tuition is spiking and there's kind of a crisis of what's gonna happen with college next. But when you have a 25% decline and a surge in people teaching people, and that's where society is going, then there is this constant need to reskill and learn new knowledge, and it's becoming easier and easier to do that. And so AI, just like, you know, the internet and so many other things before it, is just the next big thing that people are going to have to reskill against. And McKinsey's quantified the value of reskilling. They find that when individuals reskill, even if they are working at a current job, they can increase their lifetime earning by almost 36%. And so if someone is not in the mindset of being curious, you better, because you're leaving money on the table. And so even if you think that it may not impact your business, I would say have the curiosity, because it will continue to proliferate over time. Now, of course, we're authors, so, and we care about our IP. We don't want it in ChatGPT, and we don't want it, you know, to replace the value that we bring. And so it's interesting to figure out what this balance is going to be between AI surfacing up new ideas, making new connections that people may normally not have done, versus it replacing the intellect of groups of individuals. And I think that's where a lot of the worry comes from, is that it's going to replace intellect. Major brands like Heinz have already created campaigns using AI. And so earlier this year, they had a campaign where they typed into different AI engines like ketchup, just to see what imagery would come back. And do you know, 90% of times it's a Heinz bottle. Huh. And so it's also a really great opportunity to do research. Sure. Because it's a large language model, you can go to social media and use social media like X, I can't call it Twitter anymore, I guess, but you can use something like that in order to find a proxy for what people are thinking. Or you can go to another large language model like a ChatGPT or Bard and find kind of what people think also, but in a very different way. So from
yeah.
a research standpoint, it is making different conclusions, but I don't see it yet fully replacing people, even though it's projected to have an impact on 40% of people. It's making individuals like doctors make smarter decisions, right? And they found that in 70% of the cases, if doctors put in symptoms, it's going to correctly diagnose what it is. And that probability is almost as high as a doctor getting it right. And so it is creating huge efficiencies across the board, but we still need doctors and we still need people to fly the planes.
Absolutely. And the new knowledge has to come from somewhere, right?
Yes.
Well, this has been just amazing. What a great conversation. So how do people learn more about what you're up to? Because you're up to a lot.
I am up to a lot. We were joking before this. I was like, I have to write down what I'm up to because sometimes I forget. The best way is to follow me on LinkedIn. I'm highly active on LinkedIn, and individuals, you can just put in Kai D. Wright and I'll come up, or you can put in linkedin.com/Kai D. Wright and I'll come up through that way too. I often like for the community to ask me questions. So if nothing was answered today in terms of a question that you may have had, then feel free to drop it in the, you know, drop it in a direct message and I'll be sure to get back to it.
That's so wonderful. Well, I'm hoping to run into you on campus one of these days.
Absolutely. I'm doing a class on behavioral science. And so campus, off campus, and always in the neighborhood. And so I really look forward to having a coffee chat next time.
There you go. We will have to do that. Well, thanks everyone for joining. Have a wonderful weekend. And I'll see you at the next Fireside. Thanks a lot.